So are we in a trade war yet?
Well, define a trade war and I'll give you that answer. Yeah.
For the past several months, the United States has been trying to gain some leverage with its trading partners.
The president slapping new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from America's closest neighbors and allies.
Sometimes it gets a bit rough.
Canadians, we're polite, we're reasonable, but we also will not be pushed around.
A few weeks ago, a new trade deal was struck with our polite Canadian friends and with Mexico.
We have successfully completed negotiations on a brand new deal to terminate and replace NAFTA and the NAFTA trade agreements with an incredible new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement called USMCA. It sort of just works. MCA.
But the aggressive trade renegotiations have continued, especially with America's biggest frenemy.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
China is imposing new tariffs on U.S. goods today after President Trump put tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports.
Here's what a Chinese trade negotiator said. It's hard to negotiate with someone when he puts a knife on your neck. I'm no expert, but that kind of sounds like a trade war.
Regardless of whether or not we are in a full-blown trade war, I think not a full-blown trade war, I think the first shots have been fired, clearly.
The modern global economy requires a delicate balance in which countries collaborate on trade while simultaneously competing against one another. This competition often requires a referee to make sure everyone's following the rules. And that referee is this man.
My name is Roberto Azevedo. I am the Director General of the World Trade Organization since 2013.
And would you describe the Director General role of the WTO as essentially a diplomatic role?
The diplomatic role of the Director General is the one that he has to perform as a builder of bridges. He has to approximate positions. You have 164 members now to guide, and they have very different perspectives of everything on politics, economics.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, a conversation with the WTO's Roberto Azevedo about what makes for a successful negotiation.
I know some people think that everything you need to know you learn in kindergarten.
We talk about whether the global economy is doing as well as the current numbers indicate.
It's amazing that I still hear people say, oh, but the economy is great. Of course it's great. It hasn't been affected yet.
And which came first, the president or the tariffs?
President Trump didn't just happen. You know, he didn't just fall from the skies.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The World Trade Organization was founded only in 1995, but has its roots in the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944, which also gave rise to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. These institutions were set up to help resuscitate and grow the post-war global economy. But the political timing wasn't right for a global trade organization. Instead, an agreement between 23 countries called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was signed in 1947. When the number of signatory countries reached 123, the agreement was formalized and given more teeth with the establishment of the WTO. Its mission is to, quote, ensure that trade flows as smoothly, predictably, and freely as possible. But in recent months, global trade has become quite a bit less smooth and much less predictable, with the U.S. threatening or enacting massive tariffs against a variety of countries and industries, with retaliatory tariffs quickly following. That's where we begin the conversation with Roberto Azevedo. We spoke a few weeks ago. I was in New York, and Azevedo was at WTO headquarters in Geneva. So we are in a particularly noisy trade environment at the moment. It's in the headlines all the time. Considering the threatened and actual tariffs emanating from the U.S., and considering the U.S. role in the global economy, what share of your time currently is taken with issues that concern directly or indirectly the U.S.?
Well, you're talking about the largest economy in the world, so it's natural that a lot of my time will have some kind of relationship with actions taken by the United States. Also because an action that is taken by the United States has repercussions everywhere across the world. So anything that the U.S. does will have a global systemic effect. So, of course, a lot of my time has to do with that. But what is important also, you have to realize that President Trump didn't just happen. You know, he didn't just, you know, fall from the skies in an ambient that was not ripe and then found traction. He is the result of a very real situation in American society and in the American economy. And if you don't understand the forces that put him there, I think that's part of getting the wrong diagnosis. And I have to tell you, there is a lot of sympathy for some things that are said on the part of the United States and that are welcome in other areas of the world, but not everything, of course.
The WTO is opposed to tariffs generally, and most economists agree that tariffs are a really distortive way to do trade. But it strikes me that there are a lot of instances where a tariff exists under a different name. One of the U.S.'s biggest complaints is that China, for instance, doesn't honor intellectual property, that rather than being bought or licensed, the property is copied. So that would essentially be a tariff on the imported version. Then there are governments that subsidize their airline industries or their agricultural industries or oil and gas and sugar. Do you, the WTO, have any ability to directly request or command that these tariffs, not by name, but in essence, be eliminated?
Absolutely. It happens all the time. Industries like protection. They want to be supported by the governments. They want to get help. And they're now seeing this uprise in what we call behind the border protection. And that happens in the form of technical barriers. It happens in the form of insufficient enforcement of certain rules, like you mentioned, intellectual property. And that's much more difficult to assess because tariffs you can measure. Tariffs you include on your spreadsheet and you prepare for to pay that additional cost. A behind the border measure, you don't know when they come. You don't know what form they will take. So it's tough. We have committees here in the WTO who discuss exactly that.
Do you have any sense, if you had to estimate the size of those untariffs, what they would be compared to the official tariff rates?
Not really. Also because some of those are perfectly legal. You would see some countries put it in place technical barriers or technical standards that are more demanding than what other countries apply. And that could be for the protection of the consumer. It could be for preventive measures. And those things are difficult to measure. But they can be very significant, definitely. In several situations, they just stop trade altogether. So that's whatever, an infinite tariff at the border. How do you measure that?
The WTO says the average tariff rate among its members fell by 15% between the organization's founding in 1995 and 2013. There are, however, many caveats. Tariff rules are less stringent for developing countries, for instance. Furthermore, trade deals negotiated in good faith by one country's administration can be deemed by a later administration to be unfair or just unpalatable. NAFTA, the U.S.-Canada-Mexico Free Trade Treaty, was signed a year before the WTO came into existence. President Trump was not a fan of NAFTA.
I have long contended that NAFTA was perhaps the worst trade deal ever made.
So he decided to tear it apart and put it back together again. The new terms, which address the auto, dairy, and other industries, are more to his liking.
Throughout the campaign, I promised to renegotiate NAFTA, and today we have kept that promise.
But when it comes to the trade deals under which the WTO operates, Roberto Azevedo defends the terms and the logic.
I understand, I think, a lot of the concerns that have been expressed by the president and others, particularly if you don't follow the evolution of the global trading system. For example, it is a fair question to ask, why does my country charge 2% when I'm importing a particular product and I want to export the same product to somebody else, I have to pay 10 or 15%? Where's the fairness in this? It's a legitimate question, I think. But it's much more complex than that. These tariffs are there because they were negotiated over 80 years. If you talk about industrial tariffs only, you're talking about more than 10,000 lines, 10,000 duties. And that's industrial only. Now, you have to add to that the agricultural side. You have to add to that deals on services as well. And it's impossible to negotiate line by line. And it's also impossible to apply a different tariff to a different country. Imagine a situation when you apply the very same tariff as the others apply to you. You have 164 countries, and then you apply a different tariff for that product for 164, and then they apply the same as yours. How do you square that circle? It's absolutely impossible. So these negotiations mm-hmm. were done on a package. So there is a balance, which is not mathematical. It is essentially a political balance that is struck. Now, what I understand as the American position at this point in time is that we have to revise this. These were bad deals. So I'm simplifying, of course, a very complex scenario. But it's just to say that we can understand the legitimacy and the perplexity of some situations, but those situations are not there by accident. They are there because there's a history behind them, and this is why we got to these tariffs and these commitments negotiated in the WTO.
Well, let me ask you this. Trump's methodology, in addition to actually enacting tariffs that are larger and more dramatic than we've seen in the past, his methodology is different in that he communicates directly to the world, primarily via Twitter. The trade negotiations the WTO works on are multi-year, considered, done around a table with a lot of negotiators and arbitrators, and they're kind of the opposite of a 280-character political message. And I'm really curious about the degree to which those proclamations are essentially effective as bargaining statements and the degree to which they are chaotic.
I think the problem you have with short but very strong, concise, and clear messages sometime is that you get the concern, you get what the problem is or what is annoying that party, but what you don't get is clarity about, okay, so how do we fix this? Sometimes the answer to this question is very broad in nature and asks for things that clearly are impossible to do. So the option on the other side is to either live with this uncertainty or take action that assumes the worst. And that, I think, is not the best way to proceed. I think what we need is not only to understand the concern, what they need to understand now is, so what? What do we do now? What are the things that we need to do, reasonably speaking, that can be done? How to actually, you know, roll up the sleeves, work and figure something out that is acceptable to everyone, that's a big challenge.
So are those challenges being met? Are those long and hard conversations actually happening? Or are we in more of a kind of stormy holding pattern at the moment?
I think we are progressively moving forward and making progress. I remember maybe a couple of years ago, there was a G20 meeting in Hangzhou, in China. And I made a presentation and I explained the situation of technology and the impact that it had in the labor market. And I gave this figure, you know, 80% of the jobs lost are lost to new technologies. Everybody was surprised at what, and that was just 2 years ago. And some people came to me right there when we broke for coffee and said, where did you get those numbers? How did you get this information? I said, it's out there. We're just not looking for it. We're not looking for the causes of all this. But if we do, the causes are pretty evident. In 2 years' time, everybody's talking about this now. This is no news any longer. And some have already begun to talk about reforming the system, reforming the WTO. They realize that some of these concerns have roots in shortcomings of the system. And unless we address this, these kind of tensions that we see today in terms of trade are only going to increase.
In addition to President Trump critiquing the WTO itself, calling it a disaster, saying if they don't shape up, I will withdraw, and his tariff activity, the U.S. has also been blocking the appointment of a WTO appeals judge, without whom the organization could really be stymied to some large degree. I'm curious if you could talk about what you are doing to try to keep the WTO from being paralyzed or stymied?
We have to fix this situation as soon as we can. By the end of next year, we may reach a critical moment when we have less than three appellate body members. That means that with less than three, we cannot hear an appeal. And therefore, basically, the system of dispute settlement collapses. But having said that, members are looking at alternatives. The first option, of course, is to get a conversation going. The misgivings of the U.S. administration with the dispute settlement mechanism of the WTO is not new. I myself had heard it before from previous administrations. People have been asking. So if you're not happy with the system, what do you think needs to change? How do we fix the problems you have? Of course, some things are not negotiable. The system will have to continue to be independent. It will have to continue to be impartial, but it can function better. What is also a bit peculiar is that the United States has been bringing cases to the WTO. They just brought five a few weeks ago.
So have you, Director General Azevedo, had direct conversations ever with President Trump, whether about the blocking the appointment of the judge, or trade itself generally, or anything? Have you had face-to-face or direct conversations with him?
Not directly, no. I do have open contacts, of course, with Robert Lighthizer, the USTR. I sometimes have conversations in different scenarios with other ministers as well, but not directly with President Trump, no.
Have you had direct conversations with the leaders of other large countries?
Yes, quite frequently. I met recently with President Macron from France, and he was very concerned with all this, and we had a very, very good conversation, and he was very much on top of what's happening. That's surprising, because a while back, whenever I talked to leaders, it took me a while to explain to them what was going on. This was not the case now. I talked to him, I talked to Prime Minister May. I'm going to be next month in Germany to talk with Chancellor Merkel. I recently was in Japan, I talked to Prime Minister Abe. I've been covering a lot of ground and we've been talking, and they're all concerned.
There is recent news that the leaders of Russia and China have gotten together and boosted their newfound strategic partnership. I'm curious how you think about, you know, the WTO has positioned itself to be theoretically a friend to all, or at least a referee to all. But when there is something proactive and maybe unilateral, like U.S. Tariffs, and other countries respond by making their own deals, I'm curious how that makes you feel as Director General of the WTO. Do you feel excluded? Do you try to get involved in those discussions and make sure they fall within the proper parameters of WTO behavior?
To be frank with you, I don't have to try very hard. They reach out for me very quickly. Sometimes I try to discourage some courses of action, but I also have to understand the the political sensitivities in many of these players. We have, I'm happy to say, conversations which are, you know, very open, very frank. And of course, I can't share with you and the listeners the content of those conversations, but they are very, very frank. And we explore all kind of options before us. I tell them about the importance of the system and not to compromise the system. And I would say that pretty much everybody I talk to tells me that the system must be preserved, even strengthened. But it's not easy under these circumstances to be, you know, toeing the line when others aren't.
Coming up after the break, with the head of the WTO on our show, of course, we're going to ask him to make some predictions about trade and the economy.
My crystal ball doesn't allow me to go that far.
Oh, well. But don't worry. Roberto Azevedo has plenty more to say, and we'll hear it after the break.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Target, presenting Future at Heart, a new podcast that explores the work of changemakers across the country and highlights projects in cities like Miami, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Future at Heart, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found. Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Roberto Azevedo, Director General of the World Trade Organization, was appointed to the post in 2013 when the trade waters were considerably less choppy than they are today. So you are from Brazil and you studied electrical engineering before becoming a diplomat. I'd like to just very quickly hear how those three factors, Brazilian, engineering, and being a career diplomat, how they inform your role as Director General of the WTO?
Brazilian. Well, the good thing about being a Brazilian is that it gives me a very diverse perspective. Brazil has is a big economy. It's a big country with several ethnicities, a very diverse cultural background, and it has aspects of a developed nation, a very sophisticated industry, but also has important aspects of developing country, very social challenges. And that gives me this different perspective. Engineer. I was always good with numbers, and I think it was natural for me to become an engineer. And it was until I met my wife. She decided to get into the diplomatic career. And at that point in time, I had to decide, you know, what would I do? An engineer married to a diplomat was going to be pretty challenging, especially when she was posted abroad. So I thought, you know what, let's work for the family. So I took the exams and I passed the exams and I joined the diplomatic career. I think that was a love story in its own right.
Can you give me a quick example of an engineering-like solution to a trade or economic problem?
So when I'm in a meeting or something like that, I try to understand the basic motivations and then figure out a way to make those motivations work together. And that's something I think that engineers do. They try to get very complex situations and problems, try to reduce them to their elemental constitutive parts, and figure out a way to make them work. Personal chemistry is very important as well, even between negotiators. I know some people think that everything you need to know you learn in kindergarten, and I think that's quite accurate. But I found out that you're forever learning how to relate to people, how to take into account the diverse personalities, cultures, objectives.
So as long as the world still has independent nations, and it seems that'll be the case for at least another few decades, that we're not becoming one big global nation, it strikes me that there is an inherent friction around trade in which every country has to strike a balance between protectionism and globalism. So I'm curious whether you agree or disagree with this notion, and however you answer, what's to be done about that?
This tension that exists even today with regard to trade, it always existed. Countries that do trade and that have a cooperative relationship with the other partners, they essentially gain from that. But it is also a reality that when you trade, some sectors in the domestic economy will lose. Many gain. Many are better off with a trading relationship, but some lose in the sense that they're not competitive enough. Sometimes the factories close in particular sector, and you cannot ignore that. I think what you see today is something different from this very traditional, very historic tension. Today, we are seeing a transformation of the economic structure of the global economy. We're producing things differently. We're producing things faster. We don't require as much human input as we did before. And this is increasing. Now, clearly, even for governments and for politicians, it is easier to blame, you know, the foreign for these problems which are happening inside their own economies. It's easier to blame the imports for the loss of jobs when they are they have a role, of course, but they are minor in this structural change. And I think if we don't realize that and if we don't try to find a solution for this, we will be hurting much more than help it.
Okay, so you've just described, I would argue beautifully and succinctly, a big problem that, of course, a lot of economists and some others have described. But you're right, that's not the political rhetoric. So it's easy to think of what's the wrong medicine. How involved is the WTO in trying to discover and administer the right medicine?
I think the WTO is already at least trying to help governments and public opinion to understand the situation and reach the right diagnosis. If we get the wrong diagnosis, you get definitely the wrong medicine. The important thing to understand is that whatever medicine we choose, it's not going to work overnight. There is no quick fix for this. This is essentially something akin to the Industrial Revolution. So there will be a need to rethink the whole educational system in countries, how to support the displaced people, those who lost their jobs but cannot find a job somewhere else in the economy. How do you help them find another economic activity that will work for them and will help them support their family? And the state, of course, I understand that people don't want this. I myself have very strong reservations against a big state. But the state at least has to think about this and think about the mechanisms that will allow us to handle these displaced masses of workers.
You've said that if you want the truth in trade, you have to get into the numbers, which a political discussion almost inevitably doesn't. Can you talk about that for a moment and maybe give a particular example of where the political discussion on trade is just wrong or shallow or only partially true and what needs to be done to address that?
One of the big problems we have is that politicians are looking at the electoral cycle. They're looking at the next elections. So proposing solutions that will last 10, 15, 20 years or that would take 10, 15, 20 years to come about is no good. The voter doesn't want to hear any of that. They want immediate. It's amazing that I still hear people saying, oh, but the economy is great. Of course it's great. It hasn't been affected yet. There is, I would call it, I don't know, maybe an incubation period that you have to go through. And politicians, I think it's easier for them to say, oh, don't worry, you know, what we're doing is okay. See, the economy is fine. Nothing happened.
You mentioned that most people assume that job loss, especially in manufacturing, is due to, you know, trade issues, whereas in fact, technology is behind an awful lot of job loss. And we've discussed that on this program before. We discussed that with Christine Lagarde, who made the point that that perception, or maybe misperception, was and remains really a big part of a lot of the political movements in Europe and elsewhere, including Brexit. As you've mentioned, people like to look for the villain. I'd like you to talk about Brexit for a moment. I'd like you to talk about what you feel were the legitimate and maybe illegitimate factors that produced it, and where the WTO stands on it now, what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, the first thing to say about Brexit in particular is that it tends to be bunched together with all of these other phenomena that you see happening in the world, particularly in terms of protectionism. And I would say Brexit is somewhat different. Brexit was more a child of migration policies and sovereignty issues. Of course, these things are difficult to quantify, but I would say they played a much bigger role than any kind of tension introduced by trade. So that's the first distinction I would say. Brexit, again, is part of this transformative structural changes that we see out there. A lot of a very significant part of the population feels left behind. And they feel that somebody has to look at me, something has to happen, and nobody's doing that. It was more like an anti-establishment kind of vote rather than a vote for a certain political alternative. It was more the kind of vote of no more, we need to change, and people had better listen, rather than having a clear, well-formulated agenda for either social or political policies.
So as everyone knows, predicting the future of economics and politics and so on is really hard. To me, one of the least predicted developments that very much affects global trade is the rise of the U.S. as an oil exporter. So it's estimated that next year the U.S. will surpass Saudi Arabia to become the number one exporter in the world, in large part because of fracking and other technologies. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on this, considering that importing oil has for so long been a major part of not only the U.S. economy, but also U.S. political concerns.
I think it will change things considerably, even in terms of geopolitics. And I would say that what we're seeing, this phenomenon that we're seeing with the shale oil, is just the tip of the iceberg. Every scientist, every economist that has been digging into this tells me that we are on the verge of major breakthroughs in the energy field, and that the cost of energy may go down very, very significantly. And that includes electric energy. So, for example, the combustion engine for the automobile industry, some say, is in the last stages. I don't know. My crystal ball doesn't allow me to go that far.
The economist and law professor Jagdish Bhagwati at Columbia has said this about the world trading system. He said, it's characterized by a chaotic crisscrossing of preferences with a plethora of different trade barriers applying to products depending on which countries they originate from. This is a fool's way of doing trade. It sounds as though you largely agree that that we get to where we get through a strange brew of evolution and history and best efforts and things changing over time. So let me just leave you with this final question. If you, as Director General of the WTO, had for a day or a week some kind of magic wand to make things more equitable, more transparent, tell me a few things that you would do to help make a little bit more order and equity out of this chaos.
I think the biggest challenge for us is to have a conversation. I would try to make sure that we give space for more discussions. Whenever you sit, if the two sides, or three or four, or how many sides, want a solution, a solution will come. I will give you one anecdote, something that happened with me, actually. I was at a negotiating table, and we all had very significant political problems at home, right? And we were struggling with the language of a provision. It was a very important provision for everyone. And in the middle of the conversation, somebody said, why don't we write this down like this? And he gave a, you know, he drafted a sentence. And I said, what the hell does that mean? I don't understand this sentence. And the other said, I don't either. And nobody understood the sentence. They said, okay, so let's take it. Nobody knew what it meant, but it worked for everyone precisely because nobody knew what it meant. And then we got an agreement. So when you want things done, you can find a way, but you have to sit down and be determined that you want a solution.
I appreciate the call for conversation. I assume if President Trump were to hear this conversation and call you, you'd be happy to go visit and try to sit down and work some things out, yes?
Oh, I'm always available. I'm always available.
Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, here's what we typically hear about the relationship between governments and economic growth.
My God, the government, what a basket case group of bureaucrats. They don't know what they're doing.
Today, we'll hear an alternate take on that argument from the economist Mariana Mazzucato. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Stitcher or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Target, presenting Future at Heart, a podcast on changemakers and the projects they're championing in communities nationwide. Future at Heart, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found.
This is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
So I wouldn't say that my path to economics was through Marxism, but it was through reading some very inspirational economists, of which one was definitely Karl Marx.
That's Mariana Mazzucato.
I'm a professor in the economics of innovation and public value at University College London.
You also advise, as far as I can tell, a number of governments and governmental institutions.
Sure. So I'm currently on the Council of Economic Advisors for the First Minister of Scotland. I'm also the special advisor for Carlos Modas, who's the research commissioner in the European Union. And I used to be on the advisory board for Jeremy Corbyn. And then I resigned because of Brexit.
It says here, a special advisor to the Secretary General of the OECD, is that right?
Yes, so the OECD is currently rethinking its economic narrative. And so they have a group that's literally called that, the new economic narrative. And I'm one of the people on that group.
Gotcha. And also Citra's advisory panel in Finland, is that true?
Or
is
oh,
that
yeah, still current? Sorry, I didn't realize you wanted the whole list. Yes, there's actually even like 30 more.
How can it be that one university economist has the ear of so many governments and institutions? For a clue, let's get back to why Mazzucato found such inspiration in Karl Marx.
One thing that's fascinating about Marx is that he's known as a critic of capitalism. But actually, when you read Capital, Volume 1, 2, and 3, you end up really admiring and appreciating the dynamic aspect of capitalism, which is technological change. We shouldn't forget that feudalism was 500 years of inertia. One of the defining features of capitalism is, in fact, the way that innovation has really broken down all sorts of walls, that is constantly changing how industries operate, how production, distribution, and consumption work. And Marx really talks about that. So it's quite curious that one of the most famous critics of capitalism actually described it in the most dynamic of all ways. And that's what got me interested in the economics of technological change.
But it's not just technological change that interests Mazzucato. She has a relatively radical stance on the value that's created by technological change. What do I mean by a radical stance? Consider the titles of her books. The first was called The Entrepreneurial State. Those two words, entrepreneurial and state, typically are not used together. Mazzucato's latest book is called The Value of Everything, Making and Taking in the Global Economy. When it comes to the relationship between government and economic growth, Mazzucato knows how the popular narrative goes. It goes like this.
my God, the government, what a basket case group of bureaucrats. They don't know what they're doing.
But she sees it differently.
You know, what would Uber be without GPS, publicly financed? What would Google be without the internet, publicly financed?
Mariana Mazzucato was born in Rome, but grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, where her father took a job as a research physicist at the university. She studied history and international relations at Tufts and got her PhD in economics at the New School for Social Research in New York. Now she lives with her family in London. In an interview with the Financial Times, Lunch with the FT, where you go and have lunch and a glass of wine, you said...
Well, a very expensive glass of wine.
I saw that. The glass of wine you ordered cost £40.
I made an error.
They made an error.
Well, I didn't see the price. This is how they trick you. No, they trick you. They trick you. I don't know if it's because I was a woman and they didn't show me the price, you know, to be gentlemen, or if it's what the FT does. But there was no prices. I was so involved in the conversation. I just pointed to the first wine I saw, and it turned out to be the most expensive wine that got anyone who read that article to call me a Sauvignon socialist.
Right. So to someone who says, you know, free markets are almost always good and governments are almost always bad, to someone who says that, you say what?
The first is, what do you mean by the free market? And it's curious, if you read Adam Smith, one of the first economists back in the late 1700s, he actually meant by the word free market, not free from the state, but free from rent-seeking, free from those activities that extract value. So what I say to those who say that, you know, we need less state in order to be more innovative, more dynamic, I say, well, let's look at one of the most innovative parts of the U.S. economy, which is Silicon Valley. Did that come from the free market or from an active, visible hand, the state? My point is, actually, the state was involved in almost everything in Silicon Valley. Not to exclude the role of the private sector. Of course, we all know the very important companies in that area. But the role that public actors played was really across the whole innovation chain.
So you're talking about agencies like DARPA and NASA and the National Institutes of Health and so on, yes?
Exactly. I'm talking about both agencies that do basic research, like the National Science Foundation, but also agencies more downstream doing applied research, like DARPA, but also its sister organization in more recent times called ARPA-E, the National Institutes of Health, which continue to spend more than $30 billion a year in the most radical, uncertain, high-risk research.
Here's some evidence of the government funding that Mazzucato is talking about. DARPA, or the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, created during the Cold War to keep American technology ahead of the Soviets, has over the years produced several kinds of missiles and airplanes, as well as the first computer mouse, miniature GPS receivers, HD displays, and a digital personal assistant. ARPA-E, or the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, founded under George W. Bush, has funded a variety of energy projects, including battery storage tech. The Department of Energy, starting in 1978, invested more than $130 million studying the extraction techniques that have come to be known as fracking. And the National Institutes of Health has helped fund the vast majority of all new drugs approved by the FDA.
These public institutions have absolutely co-created value. It's quite extraordinary that we've become very used to these kind of much more passive words to describe the state. You start having to change the vocabulary that one uses. So instead of saying the public sector de-risks the private sector, it's actually about sharing risks. Instead of talking about just facilitating and enabling business, it's really about, you know, taking on the lead investor role as an investor first resort.
One of the central arguments you make is that government institutions and quasi-government institutions are involved in the investment, are involved in the risk, and yet, you argue, barely share in the return. How big of a problem is that?
So it's a huge problem, and it comes back to how we talk about things. I often remind people, that Plato said that storytellers rule the world. So these stories that we tell about who creates value has in fact created the stories that justify the extraction of value. So let me give you an example, which I think brings us home. The U.S. government, after the crisis, decided to have a proper fiscal stimulus program of close to $800 billion. And part of that agenda was really also to direct that fiscal stimulus towards the green economy. So you might remember that Obama financed some companies like Solyndra through the U.S. Department of Energy through a guaranteed loan that was for about $500 million. And that company went bust.
There are new questions tonight about a cornerstone of Stimulus One, a $535 million loan to a company called Solyndra that makes solar energy panels.
Why does the taxpayer have to be the one footing the bill to try and see if solar power works?
People said, my God, the government, what a basket case group of bureaucrats. They don't know what they're doing. They shouldn't be picking winners. They should just really do this kind of facilitating roles of, you know, construct some roads, education, infrastructure, and then get out of the way, which, first of all, completely misses the point that actually the U.S. government, in terms of energy, has been the lead financer of areas like solar and wind, alongside other governments, but also nuclear. Fracking itself came out of a U.S. government financing early on. But more concretely, at the same time that it was financing Solyndra, it also financed Tesla for a very similar amount of money. So the Tesla S car got a $465 million guaranteed loan. And when I say guaranteed, I'm talking about guaranteed by the U.S. taxpayer. So when Solyndra went bust, the taxpayers were pretty angry that they had to pick up the bill. But why did the taxpayers not know that they had also financed Tesla? Wouldn't that have changed the narrative and the perception of what these bureaucrats in Washington were doing? They actually had a portfolio, like any venture capitalist, which, you know, takes on risk. And so speak to any venture capitalist, they will tell you that for every success, there's many failures. However, if you really want to be a venture capitalist, you have to construct your portfolio in such a way that you also get some of the upside from the wins precisely to cover that downside. And the U.S. government didn't do that. So not only had they failed on the marketing side, they hadn't actually communicated to U.S. citizens of all these successful U.S. investments, which include everything in your iPhone or smartphone, from the internet, GPS, touchscreen display, Siri, all government financed. But in this particular case, people didn't know that Elon Musk himself had received, you know, financing for Tesla. And Elon Musk, by the way, has received a total of $5 billion. That's billion, that's nine zeros.
That $5 billion has been spread across Musk's three companies, Tesla, SpaceX, and SolarCity. Mazzucato says that taxpayers should be getting a much better return for investments like these.
So what the U.S. government actually did with Tesla was the opposite of what they should do. They said, thinking they were quite wise, if you fail to pay back the loan, we get 3 million shares in your company. And you have to ask yourself, you know, why all these Goldman Sachs guys who were, in fact, in Obama's government didn't actually come through when they were needed, because they should have said the opposite. If you do pay back the loan, we get 3 million shares. And the price per share when the loan was taken out in 2009 was $9 a share. When it was paid back in 2013, it was $90 a share. That difference multiplied by 3 million would have more than paid back the Solyndra loss and the next round. Then the question becomes, how do you share not only the risks, but also the rewards? So we don't get what we get with the banks, which is that, you know, when things go bad, the state has to bail them out. And when things go well, the banks take the profits.
So let me ask you about two specific areas that you talk about. One is, I guess, you know, one term for it is information and communication technology, or what we all think of as roughly the digital revolution. And another is pharmaceuticals. And you argue that in both cases, there's been a massive government investment in the U.S. and a relatively terrible return on the investment to the government, at least. Is that still a current argument? Is it still the case that agencies like DARPA and NASA or parallel versions are still so strongly involved in the innovation? Or was that a golden era of government investment and research that now needs, in your view, to be rebooted?
So the first part of the answer is business has changed. It's become increasingly financialized. This is a huge problem. The two sectors where this is the biggest problem is precisely pharmaceuticals, where companies like Pfizer and Amgen are spending over 100% of their net income on areas like share buybacks and dividend payouts. And of course, energy with the big possible green tech revolution. Now, in terms of the government investments, on the one hand, they continue to be absolutely fundamental. So in, you know, the emerging green economy, it was actually ARPA-E, which came out with one of the biggest innovations in battery storage. Again, fracking, which has changed the international landscape around energy, was also financed by government.
To what degree was fracking, for instance, funded by the government?
To what degree? Well, you should remember that the main thing is when. So when it was still extremely uncertain, extremely risky, where there was no private finance, government was making those early investments. So in terms of the actual amount and percentage of the total, that's not really the issue. It's who took on the early risk. And so that's why we should stop using words like lender of last resort for government financing and use more words like investor of first resort, because that's in fact the role it plays. Now, in terms of all these organizations like NSF and DARPA and the National Institutes of Health, they're still spending a lot of money, especially in the high risk, high uncertain phases, high capital investment phases. However, they've been under attack. But the real issue shouldn't just be the budget. It should be the ability of these organizations to continue to really lead the way, to have missions which aren't asked in the Budget Appropriations Committee, you know, what is the economic value going to be? Because had they thought about net present value and cost benefit and, you know, economic value as economists think of it in terms of jobs today and patents, et cetera, then there's no way we would have done the Man on Moon mission. That actually required a certain level of ambition, of imagination, of a willingness to dream. So any country that's interested in tackling areas around climate change or rethinking 21st century healthcare systems, tackling the aging demographic crisis, these are all broad challenges, which unless we really frame them as missions, then we're not going to be able to tackle any of these grand challenges. That's what we should be learning instead of, oh, we need more venture capital.
So you're making an argument that the U.S. government is not getting enough credit for its investment in the past through agencies like DARPA, NASA, and in the pharma area and so on. You also argue separately that they're not getting enough return on the investment, which that sounds, you know, believable. But you also argue that the high return and relatively low tax environment for entrepreneurs and investors is not a big driver. And I want to know what the evidence is for that. I mean, I look at the U.S. as, you know, one question you ask is, where are Europe's Googles? What happens differently in the States than in Europe to produce these companies like Google, Facebook, et cetera? There are certainly a lot of people in private equity, in venture capital, in the startup culture who say that because of the capital gains tax environment, because of the carried interest loophole, that helps create the very large incentive to make these companies that turn out to be super rich. And I'm not even saying these handful of companies that turn out to be super rich are necessarily so good for society. I think that's a bigger discussion for another day. But I just want to know, what's your evidence that that incentive is not really important and is perhaps a key factor in why this is happening in the U.S. and not in Europe?
So my answer is, first of all, what happened in the U.S. is that there was a system of innovation, which lacks in many European countries, where you had patient finance, but also active mission-oriented agencies, which really thought about big problems. So going to the moon, which required many different sectors to innovate, including clothing, not just aeronautics, and then instruments, including prizes and procurement policy, which allowed startups to scale up. Right? Startups in and of themselves, who cares? Just because you have a startup. What's interesting is if you have a system, an entrepreneurial ecosystem, I don't believe in entrepreneurs, I believe in entrepreneurial ecosystems, which actually allow startups to scale up. And so, you know, interestingly, Europe has learned the wrong lessons from Silicon Valley. And this is partly because of how the U.S. talks The U.S. talks Jefferson, but it acts Hamilton. So, you know, Jefferson talked more about getting the state out of the way, and Hamilton, before getting into his duel with Burr, who was buried, by the way, in the town I grew up in, Princeton, New Jersey, was very much about an active industrial strategy. So Europe, interestingly, I think, has learned all the wrong lessons. China, on the other hand, and this is really curious, China has learned the right lessons. China is actually doing for the green economy what the U.S. government did for the IT revolution. At the same time that Trump, Donald Trump, is dismantling what I call the entrepreneurial state.
Coming up next week on Freakonomics Radio, we'll continue this conversation and talk about how you, the taxpayer, lose out when it comes to, for instance, pharmaceuticals.
So what we actually have is the taxpayer paying twice, both for the very, very, very high basic research spending and then for these extremely high prices.
And what kind of solutions does Mazzucato have?
Yes, so I think it would be good if I ran the world.
In the meantime, check out the Freakonomics Radio archive at freakonomics.com or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or any other podcast app. And remember to be very nice to the public radio station on which you're listening to this show, especially if and when they ask for your financial support. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.